So this is, we've already heard a lot about this picture, so I'm not going to describe it. The challenge that I'm going to address is, could there be any sort of crisp observational evidence that this is the correct picture for the universe on large scales? So I'll start with some observations. If we decide that this picture is motivated by the string landscape, well, the string landscape is big because of compactification, and there's no special reason to consider four-dimensional compactification, sorry, compactifications that have four large dimensions as opposed to any other dimensionality. And so in particular, there could be 3D or other dimensional the sphere of vacua. And so the question that I want to ask is, do any of these possibilities lead to cosmological observable effects? So we're going to focus in on one particular example just because, you know, we can't solve everything at once. And this is a case where the bubble in which our bubble universe nucleates, what we call the parent vacuum, has only two large spatial dimensions. So we're imagining that one of our large spatial dimensions is compactified in this parent vacuum, and it's going to become decompactified in the tunneling process that generates our universe. I should note that there was previous work on transdimensional multiverse questions, including members of the audience. Oh, I should also say that this is work that was done with Jose Blanco Pilato, who also did some of this prior work, and Sean Carroll and Matt Johnson are in the audience as well. Work that occurred after that includes work by Peter Graham, Ronnie Harnick, and Surjit Rajendran. That work was done sort of concurrently with the some of our early projects on this. And also, there was work a few months after that by these folks. All right, so what we have in mind specifically is that this dimension that's large in our vacuum but small in the parent vacuum, let's call this dimension Z. We want it to be constant and fixed and compactified in that parent vacuum. So we imagine a potential which looks sort of like, sorry, so we imagine that the scale factor for that dimension, or the modulus for that dimension, sits in effective potential which looks sort of like this. So in the parent vacuum, it's sitting here in this minimum. This is describing how it has constant size because it's just a single point here. I've given this positive false vacuum energy. So the other dimensions, the 2 plus 1 other dimensions, are expanding as if they're in, you know, locally de Sitter space. And although this is classically stable, most of us, I guess Ben Schlaer might disagree, but a lot of us think that what's going to happen is that this field is going to eventually tunnel through that barrier, and then it runs away to infinity. As it runs away to infinity, now we have a scale factor or modulus which is growing with time, and so this will eventually become a large dimension just like the other dimensions, and a local observer may be, unable to distinguish the fact that it was once compact. So let me try to make this a little concrete. This is just a toy model, but we wanted to make sure that it made that our calculations actually made sense. We're going to start with the metric constants, which I have here. The barred quantities are in the 3D effective theory, which excludes this compact dimension. The modulus you see here is this field psi, and I'll explain this term in a minute. It's important to note that we take as part of the ansatz that this modulus and the 3D metric are independent of this compact dimension Z, and it's going to be scaled so that it runs from 0 to 2 pi. So integrating out that Z dimension, you get this effective action. We can choose alpha right so that this modulus becomes just a scalar field in the effective theory. And I put this factor of psi out front here so that the effective theory was in the Einstein frame. And you can see that this scalar, the modulus that becomes a scalar in the effective theory, does acquire a potential, but it's not sufficient to stabilize it. That's not surprising because all we've done is taken a de Sitter, you know, positive vacuum energy solution and integrated out one dimension. So we need to add some extra ingredients in order to try to stabilize this field. The ingredient is going to be a complex scalar with a Lagrangian of this form. This is just the simplest thing that we could think of. This quantity x here is just the sort of the canonical kinetic term. We're going to need to consider non-canonical kinetic terms in order to get this to work. It's not hard to check that this admits an approximate solution of this form that has the field sort of winding around the z dimension. In that case, your canonical kinetic term picks up a dependence on psi due to the metric factors in there. And this term will be negligible. And so the appearance of psi here is going to give you additional terms that will contribute to the effective potential for psi. And in particular, if we choose a kinetic function of this form, then we get an effective potential of this form, which is exactly the thing that I plotted in the previous slide. I want to admit openly that we just picked this thing ad hoc. We just wanted to show that we could get something to work. There's no reason to consider a connective function of this particular form, except you do need at least these three terms in order to get a metastable solution that also has positive vacuum energy. Otherwise, you're stuck with ADS metastable solutions or just unstable hilltop solutions. And I also want to make clear that we can choose parameters that both give a metastable minimum and satisfy the null energy condition. And so we believe that this is a classically stable solution, even under local perturbations. All right, so that's just a picture of the plot again. So now we have an effective 3D theory with a scalar field and a local minimum. That's not the global minimum. And so we should be able to apply the same sort of arguments that Coleman and DeLucia use. We're in the Einstein frame as well. The only difference is we're in three dimensions instead of four dimensions. That just changes the symmetries obeyed by the instanton, which changes some numerical factors in the equations, but nothing else. And I want to emphasize that our metric onsots, because the modulus is independent of z, it guarantees that this is these are the only symmetries of the tunneling instanton, and in particular that there's no z dependence in there. But we've checked that there's some sort of crude scaling arguments for the instanton that indicate that the curvature scale of it can be made much bigger than the size of that extra dimension. So you expect that onsots to sort of be sort of robust. All right, so this is a picture people typically draw when they draw Coleman-DeLucia tunneling. In the 3D picture, this conformal diagram is suppressing a circle. So that's a circle with radius cinch c inside the bubble here, for instance, and some conformal factor, which is describing the scale factor. When we go to the 4D picture, in this case, all we're doing is adding a circle, an additional suppressed circle everywhere, is a circle of fixed radius because we're not imagining any topology-changing transitions. All that's changing is the conformal factor of this circle, which is basically the scale factor or the modulus of that dimension. So in the thin wall limit, this conformal factor is basically independent of time. It's just some constant out here in the parent vacuum. It takes a jump across the bubble wall due to the instanton transition, and then it's flat until it reaches the null cone here, and then inside it's going to be the scale factor in the bubble. Since we're putting a four-dimensional cosmological constant inside that bubble, it's going to expand exponentially at late times. I should have mentioned that more explicitly before. We are putting a four-dimensional cosmological constant in this theory. That theory is that cosmological constant is going to become the inflaton in the bubble. All right. So, neglecting the back reaction of the bubble wall, we can come up with some simple metric solutions. The apparent vacuum looks like this. This is your 2 plus 1 dimensional de Sitter, and that's your circle. Inside the bubble, you have open FRW in three dimensions, and then you have this expanding dimension, which is your preferred direction, the z direction. To solve for these scale factors A and B, we need to actually put some matter in the bubble. At the early times, we're going to assume that the only thing that contributes significantly towards the energy density is these terms that we introduced to stabilize the extra dimension. This includes the four-dimensional cosmological constant, which, as I said, is going to be interpreted as the inflaton. At the level of analysis here, it doesn't matter. We're completely ignoring that there's slow roll and tilt and reheating. Of course, a realistic model, you have to come up with a means of constructing a microscopic theory which can incorporate these. But we're setting that aside for future work. And I'm also going to keep this subleading term for reasons that I'll explain later, but write it in this way. So I'm writing the effective potential now, not in terms of psi, but in terms of the scale factor for the z dimension in the bubble. And I'm just going to write these constants as k. This k is like g times the size of the extra dimension squared times the four-dimensional effective potential here. So we can imagine that this quantity k could be order 1, which is a limit that we want to consider. But we could also imagine that it's very small compared to 1, which is also a useful limit. In particular, in the limit where k is much less than 1, we can just ignore this quantity next to this one. And you obtain these simple scale factor solutions. The scale factor here corresponds to the de Sitter solution in the bubble. And then this is the solution you find for the scale factor of the Z dimension, which you can see asymptotes to looking much like that one. All right, during inflation, let me just note that it's obvious that you have anisotropy here in the initial geometry of the bubble because you have different scale factors. And furthermore, you have this open curvature only on two spatial dimensions instead of all three. That anisotropy, though, will be redshifted away during inflation. But as we know, it can become significant again during radiation or matter domination if you're lucky, if inflation doesn't last too long. We're going to define two parameters that parameterize this anisotropy at late times. One is simply related to the standard curvature parameter and can be written in terms of the scale factor and Hubble rate in that way. And the other one is the difference in Hubble rates looking along the preferred direction or looking along the other directions. And it's an observational fact that these quantities are small in our universe, so we can use them in a perturbative expansion to solve for the scale factor evolution. And that's what we're going to do. And we're also going to assume that there's only matter domination between, say, reheating, when these quantities we know are negligible, and the present, when they're actually still negligible, but they could be more significant. That's just to allow for simple analytic solutions. I'd also like to note that this work that studied the scale factor evolution from the surface of light scattering to the present and looked at the consequences of that, that was first done by this group, the Peter Graham, Ronnie Honarak, and Surjit Rajendran group. So, just to give you a flavor of the results, after you rescale the Z dimension to make the A and B scale factors have the same leading order solutions, these are the sub-leading pieces. I'm noting them here just so you can see that they are coming, the anisotropy, the difference between the scale factor evolution in A and the one for B, is of order this curvature parameter. But also you can sort of see why, maybe hints of why I included this factor K, because if K is precisely equal to 1/2 or very close to equal to 1/2, then you can see that the expansion, the scale factor B and the scale factor A are going to be very similar to each other. And we use these solutions to solve for the trajectories of null cones so that we can solve for the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect coming from C and D temperature. All right, so this is the first observable that I want to look at, is what is the temperature of C and D photons as they come upon some local detector. These are usually written in terms of these multiple moments, and so this is just a standard expression. This theta and phi are the coordinates on a two-sphere local to the detector. We want to propagate a temperature fluctuation on the CMB, on the surface of last scattering to that detector. The geometry around the detector is, of course, flat, but the geometry around at the surface of last scattering can have some curvature on it if there's not too much inflation. So we want to be wary of that. This leads to two effects that enter into the temperature fluctuation. One is the standard temperature fluctuation. This is the delta star, which is just the difference in temperature on different points on the surface of less scattering. And there's also an anisotropy due to the different redshifts of photons coming from different directions in the sky, because the scale factor expansion is different in different directions in the sky. So, for instance, this redshift anisotropy can be solved for using those scale factor solutions. It looks like this. There's a homogeneous component which just shifts what you thought was the temperature of the CMB. And then there's this quadrupole component, which will be important later, coming in at order of the curvature parameter today. But again, you can see that if the scale factor evolution is such that we tune the modulus potential so that it's close to 1/2, then the scale factor evolutions in the two direction in the various directions is such that this quadrupole does not contribute significantly. The temperature fluctuation on the surface of last scattering, we're going to do the stupidest, simplest thing, which is to just equate it with the fluctuations in some scalar field, which we take to be massless or very small mass, and it's going to receive its fluctuations during that de Sitter region. And also, we're going to ignore the processing that occurs to these perturbations after they enter the horizon. So technically, these results only apply to large scales, but we're assuming they give us a flavor of results that extend to very small scales, and those are actually what we're going to be interested in the end. All right, so this involves performing a mode expansion for the scalar field. I'm mentioning this only so that I can point out that the Fourier modes, the spatial modes of the scalar field, are not your normal spherically symmetric modes. They're anisotropic modes due to the large-scale anisotropic spatial curvature on the background, and that's a very important fact. The mode functions here, the temporal mode functions, will also be adjusted, also be affected by the fact that you have the different scale factors in different directions. But that's going to be an effect which is only going to affect, that's going to be a feature that only affects the smallest L's, the largest scales in the CMB. So these are just solved by looking at the equations of motion. Similarly, with these mode functions, the mode functions aren't an easy calculation. We received a lot of help by looking at the papers of these folks, some of whom are here, Neil Turok and Joam Garriga. They looked at the case of 3 plus 1 dimensional open inflation, not our situation, but the reasoning sort of follows. That's interesting. So I'm going to get seasick in a moment. So the quantity we're interested in is the multiple correlator here, which is defined in this way. And as you might guess from this quadrupole in the redshift anisotropy, it picks up a quadrupole correction in addition to the one that you normally get. This has the proper coefficients for that term. And as you might have guessed, there's a quadrupole. It has order omega, order of the curvature parameters today. And this is a severe observational constraint on this particular model, because we know from observation that the quadrupole is of order 10 to the minus 5 or so, which means that the curvature parameter today should also be of order 10 to the minus 5 or less. This is going to constrain the size of the effects that we're interested in. On the other hand, I kept this k along so I could argue that at least it's possible to see these effects even with larger curvature, because you can imagine a fine-tuned modulus potential in which this factor k was 1/2, and then this quantity is suppressed, and then the curvature parameter would just be constrained by the WMAC constraints, which say it's something like 10 to the minus 2 or a little bit less than that. So in presenting the results here, just to keep things simple, I'm going to focus on the case k equals 1/2, which is this fine-tuned case, and the case k much less than 1, which is maybe what you might consider the more natural case. Just as some technical matters, in the actual expression for these multiple moments, there's a sum over this wave number s corresponding to the z dimension. We're going to convert this sum into an integral, and furthermore, we're only going to use the asymptotic power spectrum. This is so that we can perform one of the integrations analytically, and our computers run much faster. Otherwise, it would take forever to perform these calculations. The effects of these approximations is, so considering this s to be replaced by an integral is essentially saying that the size of your formally compact dimension, your z dimension, is much bigger than the surface of last scattering, whereas in principle you could imagine that's actually just a little bit bigger than the surface of last scattering. By making that assumption, we're neglecting certain interesting effects that you might have at low multiples due to the size of that dimension being just bigger than that, the surface of last scattering. It would be interesting to look at in the future, but we just, you know, it was too computationally difficult for us. This assumption is also going to affect the small l components of the multiple correlator, because we're not probing the exact power spectrum. We're probing just the, you know, we're replacing it with this approximation, which is only valid for the large q and large s. But we're not too worried about that, because there aren't many L's at the small L, but also because we're making other assumptions. For instance, we haven't looked carefully at the question of supercurvature modes, which will affect that those low L multiples as well. So I'm going to parameterize the anisotropy by taking the difference between the what you might call the exact or the solution, and then the solution in the limit where this curvature parameter goes to zero. So that gives me, and then dividing out the appropriate multiple component and the isotropic component. So this gives me sort of the fractional variation in these components. K is, it's a parameter related to the modulus potential. So it's technically proportional to Newton's constant G times the size of the extra dimension squared times the subleading correction to the modulus potential. So the part that's not going like lambda over 8 pi G, but the next part. So you could think of it as just some parameter in the microscopic theory describing the modulus potential. There's no reason to expect it to be tuned to 1/2, This is just something I'm doing to make the, you know, so I can claim more interesting results. The sort of naive expectation would be that this is a small parameter. So here are the results. The top table is for the very small value of k, and the bottom one is the tuned value, which is 1/2. These are looking at fixed m. This is L running this way. You can see the diagonal components receive some correction that's presumably unobservable unless you have like a precise model of inflation with all the parameters, and so you know what you expect. likewise here. But in addition to this correction, you also receive these corrections. You have off-diagonal elements with multiple moments where the two L's, L and L prime, are separated by ±2. And you can see here that in this case, they're coming in at order of the curvature parameter. The curvature parameter I factored out of all these results. And furthermore, they're increasing a little bit as you go to large L. They don't continue to increase. They're going to sort of asymptote and stop at a value very close to that one. We've confirmed that these things increase to very large L by doing some numerical simulations with very large L in there, and also some really crude crude analytics sort of guesswork that also sort of confirms the analytic results. So this is interesting, and we see that we get the same effect even if we tune the modulus potentials, that we don't have the late-time anisotropic expansion. So this is telling us that a significant portion of the effect is coming from the inflationary spectrum, and the anisotropy of the surface of less scattering, and in particular the fact that we're describing Fourier modes on that surface, which are anisotropic, and projecting them onto spherical harmonics. So a significant fraction of that exists even if we get rid of this late-time behavior. I mention this because, well, first of all, we can hope that we have a fine-tuned model in the end, but also because it inspires me, at least, to consider pursuing other geometries or other possibilities whereby we might be able to avoid that the late-time effects that contribute to the quadrupole, but still cling to some of these inflationary results, which would be an interesting signal. So in addition to having the L dependence, we also have M dependence in these CLL and these multiple correlators. That, of course, is also not the case in the isotropic case. These is a distribution of those quantities for L equals 3 and 6 in the model without fine-tuning and with fine-tuning. And you can see, again, the difference between 3 and 6, the total amplitude of the change in the variation here is unchanged. We expect that to go to very large M. So the upshot here is these effects are small. They're coming in at order of the curvature parameter. But because they extend to arbitrarily large L, we can hope to gather huge statistics by looking at lots of multiple components. With corrections coming in at order 10 to the minus 5, you'd need something like going up to L equals 10 to the 5, which I don't think is really plausible. But if you imagine fine-tuning away like an order of magnitude or more, then maybe you can hope that that you can collect enough statistics with 21 centimeter and Planck and future surveys to maybe sort of see signals like this. All right, so that was the first prediction. I'm going to go quickly because I'm like at zero time here. Through another prediction, which is bubble collisions. We've heard about them before. Here are a number of authors who worked on them. I'll just say that the situation with bubble collisions looks just like it does in 3+1 dimensions, except for, you know, if you draw this picture, instead of suppressing a 2-sphere here, we're suppressing a 2-torus. The effect of this is I've tried to draw single time two bubbles nucleating. The torus here is wrapping around the z dimension, and it's supposed to illustrate to you that the collision occurs everywhere along the z dimension at the same time because of the symmetries of the instanton. And the consequence of this is, although the calculations proceed just like in the four-dimensional case, you have one difference, which is when you compute the angular shape of this bubble, the effects of this bubble collision on the CMB sky. In the 4D case, you would have theta minus some theta nuke nucleation here, where theta nuke and phi nuke would point to the direction of where the bubble collision was. In our case, there's just theta there, because the bubble collision occurs everywhere along the z dimension, so there's no preferred direction in theta to point to. And so what this means is that the bubble collisions all occur along some great circle in the sky, which corresponds to the great circle around the preferred direction, which was a formally compact dimension. So we consider that an interesting prediction for the spectrum of bubble collisions. It would all be on some great circle. And I want to note that the effects of bubble collisions may be observable even if this omega curvature is less than 10 to the minus 5. At least that's the claim of Matt and others. And so I'll end with that since I'm out of time. I won't mention occlusions, only to say that you might think that this is all very speculative and unlikely, but it does happen somewhere in the multiverse, I assure you. Thank you.
So are you imagining that the field which is driving inflation is the moduli, or is it
No. It's very important that it's not. So in the, it would require fine-tuning that potential in crazy ways. But in particular, when you look at this, this is asymptoting the zero here. So in the 3D effective theory, there's no vacuum energy. There's only vacuum energy in the 4D theory, and we're just putting in the inflationary potential by hand. It's just. Well, I don't know where it is on my slides. But it's we're sticking it in just as an assumption about the 4D theory that it has some cosmological constant and this is going to be the inflationary energy. So in a more in a better microscopic completion of this theory, this would not be some constant here. It would be some additional fields. And you would hope that they behave in such a way that they're sort of fixed in the parent vacuum, and then after you tunnel, they sort of become unleashed, and then they roll, and you have slower inflation following
but
that.
But while it's inflating, that other direction is rolling rapidly to infinity. Is that correct?
Yes. And because this is a 4D cosmological constant, it does approach isotropy in the four-dimensional theory during inflation. This is sort of necessary.
So, but if you actually do, I mean, maybe this is a separate question, but it would seem in that picture, if that's true, then your nature of perturbations, you could generate large non-Gaussianities, also sort of isocurvature perturbations, I would think.
Because
it's a multi-field and your evolution is fast in that direction.
Oh, yes.
Versus the direction you're inflating in. So that's the direction that would be generating your perturbations.
So you're saying we should consider perturbations in the modulus field here, psi, which is this. Yes. That would be interesting to.
Because if it's moving rapidly, then most of the density perturbations that you're seeing would actually come from that direction that you're rolling.
See, I think that here's
and
the
then,
thing.
And I think you'll turn at some point, and that point, then that's where you'll generate large non-Gaussianities.
Here's what I think in response to that is, I think these are interesting points, but this the moduli field just becomes a scale factor in the 4D picture, right? And so insofar as these things asymptote to be, after these have approached to asymptote with each other, the perturbations in this field are just the metric perturbations you expect in normal cosmological perturbation theory. So I don't expect anything new to happen on small scales. It's conceivable that you have interesting things going on at large scales because, well, for one, you have this, now this, the potential of this field is contributing significantly, and you have supercurvature modes and other things, but not, I don't expect any, there might be large scale effects, I don't expect any small scale effects.
But if you're perturbing that term, then, I mean, that will come into your metric perturbations, and that would lead to real density perturbations.
You mean
right?
This here? This term?
Isn't that what you just said, though? The B term.
Yeah, that's true. That term quickly becomes negligible during inflation. It only becomes significant again after you've had a long period of radiation and matter domination. Is this your point, that you could have isocurvature perturbations at late times?
Exactly, that's my point.
Okay, that's an interesting point. We haven't thought about that.
And there are very strong constraints on that. So anyways.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes.
So you mentioned in one of your slides that the spectrum you get is not unlike the Ackermann-Karolyi
spectrum.
Oh, yeah,
I forgot to say that out loud. Sorry, people.
No, but I'm just curious. So there was a one parameter that described the statistical anisotropy, and here it's kind of buried in various parameters. So have you guys looked at the work that's been done already in WMAP data on statistical anisotropy to see how that translates into constraints on whatever parameters that would translate
into? No, we haven't looked at the data ourselves. We haven't looked at the data ourselves. I think that their one parameter is probably going to be somehow map onto our parameter here, which is ultimately tied into the number of inflations, but I don't know. I'll say about their model, while their work, I mean, I don't want to put down their work, but I think that we have a theoretically well-motivated setup here, which gives us theoretical control over the initial conditions. And their model was, I mean, this is a phenomenological model, but it was even more phenomenological in the sense that I don't think that they had really good control over initial conditions. And the specific theory that they proposed had some stability issues, and that's still being resolved. But I say that the results look similar They look similar insofar as they performed their analysis in a sort of generic way at first before they introduced a specific model. But in particular, they were computing in an anisotropic background, which is Bianchi type 1, and ours is Bianchi type 3, and so this will affect the specifics on at least the small scales of these anisotropies. Sorry, at least on the small L.
Any further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank the speakers. So all the speakers for this. Okay, so we're resuming again.